Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. My guest today is Dr. Brian Wong, and he's an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Hong Kong. He specializes in geopolitics, political and moral philosophy, and is a Rhodes Scholar and holds a DPhil in politics from Oxford and many other things. And like one or two of my guests recently, if I give you the full introduction, we shall be here at dinner time. So forgive me if I don't, but welcome.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
It's very nice to have you. And I was thinking, actually, it couldn't be at a better time to have somebody that specializes in geopolitics as a guest. I mean, we live in interesting times.
We certainly do. But then again, I say geopolitics is really a craft, I think. Regardless of what you're trained in terms of your professional discipline, you ought to take interest in, and you can cultivate a degree of expertise in, provided that you think what I call more horizontally and also diagonally, as opposed to merely vertically.
I'm either horizontally or vertically. I'm not sure. I'm trying to get expertise.
I've been told I'm vertically challenged, but that's a joke. But I'm certainly not horizontally or diagonally challenged. So there we go.
Can I introduce the idea that we're very lucky to have you, because the other day you were in one of my favourite cities, that's Shanghai. I think you were giving a talk or part of a panel or...
I was delivering the opening commencement address at the Shanghai International Debate Open this year. And I was also there doing some visits, basically, of some culturally significant sites, trying to wrap my head around a sort of very turbulent period of history. That is the first half of the 20th century in China. And many of these sites were instrumental in the Republican period and also the warlord era. And of course, subsequently, with a Japanese invasion and a fall of Shanghai, so to speak. So all in all, it's a fascinating region and part of Shanghai to be in, Wukong Road.
Yep.
And that's situated sort of right next to Huashan Luo, and also a long sort of raft of very culturally significant sites in central Shanghai, downtown Shanghai.
Right. Well, you obviously know it better than I do, but it is one of my favourite cities. And you're going to another one of my favourite cities. This time, I think it's Madrid coming up.
Yes, you're right. Yes, I'm heading there. In just 10 days' time, I'll be speaking on a panel alongside a former European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso. The both of us will have a dialogue on the future and also present of Sino-European relations.
Great, sounds good. Well, I'll be just across the water at that time in Mallorca.
Ah, very sound. Mallorca.
Good stuff. Good stuff indeed. So now, what are we going to talk about? Let's think about this, because it's a moving target, geopolitics at the moment, isn't it? Where every day you wake up to a new landscape. And let's just pick up on this. I was sent on Saturday, I think it was, by a friend, a Time magazine interview that was conducted on the 12th of April with President Donald Trump. Have you read it? What was said to me as I received it from the fellow that sent it to me was, you might want to have a stiff drink in hand as you read it. I mean, it is extraordinary. I mean, I thought it was a spoof, but we've checked it out, and apparently it's a genuine interview with the President of the United States. And when you read it, your toes will curl and your anxiety levels will go up. What do we think about the United States, in particular, with the context of Hong Kong and China in mind?
What a brilliant question. And I would say this, Jonathan. Trump is a symptom, but not the primary cause of the malaise that America confronts today. If you think about the socioeconomic inequalities, the hollowing out of the working class, the perceived and actual disconnect between the political elite and establishment and the people on the ground, but also this almost systemic paralysis and an inability to grapple with a rapidly changing world, not just in relation to the rise of China, but also vis-a-vis more fragmentation, more fracturing, more rebelliousness as seen in small and medium states that are refusing to take sides. America today is both at once super confident, almost hubristic, right? Almost condescendingly, I would say, supercilious vis-a-vis the potential contenders and challenges coming from not just China, but also, of course, the European Union to a less obvious extent. Even the European Union has long viewed itself as dependent upon the US, not anymore, or certainly not. That perception is no longer the case after that wake-up call that Vance very rudely delivered at the Munich Security Conference. And then, of course, is Russia, which has just invaded and is likely to get away with its invasion of an independent sovereign state in Ukraine, right? And the denouement of this conflict, which I don't predict as likely to take place over the next 3 to 6 months, but will eventually come before the end of this year, is very likely to deliver an outcome that's going to shock, you know, us even more. So all in all, On one hand, America is super confident. It's super hubristic. Right? And by America, I mean really the current sort of political elite calling the shots. They're toppling and have already toppled parts of the old guard and are installing themselves in their place. But on the other hand, whether it be the Trump MAGA movement or the more conventional sort of neocon hawks that have been sidelined to some extent by the newfound consensus in Washington, and even the Democrats, many amongst whom the more pro-interventionist Democrats, so to speak, there's also a deeply rooted sense of fear. Fear of a future where America can no longer unilaterally dictate the terms and references of the world. A fear, and especially from the Democratic side, of the rapid erosion of soft power and institutions on the part of the US. And I've always said that the US's greatest weapons are the US dollar. It's over 700 overseas military bases. I mean, these are possible candidates and contenders, but ultimately the real weapon that it has, right, the least obvious one, is its soft power. And that is something that Washington under Trump has done a lot of damage to, and also engaged in extensive undoing to, simply in virtue of the vacillation and also inconsistency and the naked short-termist myopia exhibited by the Trump administration. So this is what's going on in the States, especially in its elite circles. At once, they are consistently paranoid and they're also consistently hubristic. And when these two forces come together, you end up with this very toxic mixture that you currently see instantiated and embodied by Trump. And very quickly, is there anything sui generis, to use a legal term here, about Trump? Of course. He is far less strategically well thought through, far less educated and informed, far less intellectually rigorous than his Democratic opponent, President Joe Biden, or indeed the predecessors to Biden. And yet what he is uniquely, and the Dems currently aren't, is he's a man who's perceived by the underbelly, by the disenfranchised, by the disheveled and the poor and the downtrodden, to be able to speak to them and to listen to them and to communicate with them effectively. That is something that the Democratic leadership has quite frankly sort of lost its touch, its ability to channel and convey in America today. And indeed, the Republican establishment too, the Liz Cheneys, the Mitt Romneys, unfortunately, as much as I find some of their views, especially on economic matters, rather agreeable, they're not able to speak to the hearts and minds of the ordinary American citizen. So where does that leave the Sino-American relationship then, to answer the second part of your question? My prediction is that for the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to see an intensification in all-out strategic rivalry between China and the US. There will be no grand bargain to be kept. I've just got a piece coming out today explaining why I don't see a grand bargain as likely. And even if made, it wouldn't be maintained or kept because Trump does not keep his promises. But even if there were a grand bargain, this would do very little in ameliorating the distrust, the antagonism, and also skepticism towards China, that is bipartisan in Washington, as well as a determination of the Chinese leadership to achieve what it views to be socio-economic modernization and also political strengthening, which may or may not contravene some of America's sort of extended objectives of influence and strategic interest in the region. So in short, I'm fairly pessimistic about the short to medium term prognosis of the Sino-American relationship. And that also means that it's high time for Hong Kong to wake up. For far too long, Jonathan, I feel like we've depended on the benign and also mutually reinforcing and constructive nature of the Sino-American relationship. That tune of China and America getting on, getting along with one another, had been to our enrichment and benefit. But sadly, right, it's clear that that ship has now sailed. And I think it's vital that Hong Kong should actively reconsider and think about where it positions itself. Is it merely a bridge between East and West, which is a phrase I'm frankly quite sick of hearing because it's so anodyne, it's so oft-repeated and iterated as a mantra, but no one really knows what exactly it means. China and the US, is that what the East and West are about? Is it China and the UK, China and the EU? And what are we talking about here, right? In lieu of thinking about China and the US and focusing and fixating over how we can be a re-import or re-export hub vis-a-vis the US, I think we should spend more time looking at the rest of the world. And that includes the other countries of the global north, including the other four eyes and the five eyes, Northeast Asian, both Japan and South Korea, very important trading partners to Hong Kong, and of course the European Union. We've got to strengthen our relations with them through not just bolstering our professional services, which is a standard line to take, but also, in my view, setting ourselves up to be the premier site for the studying and understanding and grappling with China for all in these regions who are interested in China. We should absorb talents in humanities, social sciences, not just in STEM, but also in law, in architecture, you name it, and bring them over to Hong Kong from the global north. And that is truly vital when it comes to our value added for these regions, which also helps, by the way, repair the very much frayed relations between China and the EU over, of course, the perceived affiliation between China and Russia over the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but also, of course, the ongoing disputes over trade imbalances. Hong Kong needs to do what the mainland can't do, and re-engaging and reaching out to Europe and the UK, of course. I still consider it a part of Europe, despite it's not being a part of the EU anymore, much to my chagrin. We need to do more of that in order to put us back on the map and also to complement the mainland. We can talk more about the Global South, which is the second half of this in a subsequent parts of our conversation, but I'll just flag that I think we'd also need to do more in Hong Kong in asking what do countries in the developing world, what do countries in ASEAN, in Africa, in Latin America, what do they want from us? It's not what we want from them.
Yeah.
It's what they want from us. What do they need from us? And that's a question we aren't answering sufficiently and adequately just yet. So these are my takes.
So there's a lot in that. There's a lot in that answer. Can I just for a moment pause on education, because I read an article that you wrote not long ago in the South China Morning Post, I think, where you set out what you thought that this territory should be doing with regard to education. And I must say that resonated, because if you can get education right, if you can become an educational hub, and that means, of course, international hub, mm-hmm. It's no good looking only at our own young to educate. That seems to me a giant step up in the way we can reposition ourselves in terms of excellence. So in very simple blocks, how would we do it? I mean, we've got schools, we've got five of the top
100.
If you believe the Times, we shall for these purposes. So we've got a good start. How do we turn that in real terms into something, say, in the next 5 years?
I would say there are four thoughts I have that map onto, roughly speaking, this almost horizontal trajectory or the sort of path of progression throughout an education career, so to speak, of an individual. And that is to say, I think we should look at a secondary school and a high school education, think a bit more about the university and undergraduate education, then look at the postgrad and also R&D front, especially upstream research.
Yep.
And finally, what I call vocational and also professional education. And across all four fronts, as much that Hong Kong could do. Let's start with a high school education. As it stands, I think there's much room and appetite for increasing the number of international schools in Hong Kong, but with one critical proviso, that the prices of international schools should be rendered more affordable, not just for the middle-class household here in Hong Kong, but also for middle-class households in the mainland and middle-class families in the rest of the region, including in ASEAN, right? Because whenever I bring up the claim that we need more international schools, the challenge I get is, well, already we're struggling to recruit students. We've got to close down schools. Schools aren't doing well. But then the question there, of course, is what's causing that? Is it in virtue of the lack of demand, or is it instead the sort of pricing question and the extent to which there exist sufficient subsidies to cover and also allow for the running of high-quality international school education at lower admission fees as opposed to the fees that you see right now with incredibly high debentures and also barriers to entry? The government should subsidize, the likes of, say, ESF, but also encourage new tenders who are willing to come in and set up offshore campuses or rather overseas campuses. Harrow's already got a campus here. Why not a few others along the way that I can think of? And I'm certain that there'd be interest as well. So that's phase number one and stage number one.
And can I just interrupt to
Absolutely.
Ask you this? It also strikes me that I'm not sure we're terribly good at promoting our schools.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if English are very good at promoting their schools.
Yes.
The Canadians are pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Funnily enough, the Americans I don't see promoting very much. But Canada, Australia and England are really good at promoting.
I was walking on the streets of Ho Chi Minh the other day and I bumped into a group of ethnic Vietnamese students speaking Cantonese. I was surprised. I was like, wait, you speak Cantonese, but that doesn't sound like it's Cantonese. It sounds Vietnamese Cantonese. Why is that? And they told me they were students at Polytechnic. They were here studying at PolyU and that they were just back visiting families for the holidays and so forth.
Mm.
And so I asked them, can you tell me a bit more about the Vietnamese student community here in Hong Kong? And he said this. He said, we've got a pretty sizable presence in PolyU and also USD, but we don't really have that much of a Hong Kong U presence, as in there aren't that many Vietnamese students in HKU. And I said, why is that? And the answer I got was shocking. They said, many Vietnamese communities, academic communities, high schools, elite high schools, they regularly receive notices and information, info flyers from Singaporean universities and a handful of other universities in the region they only stumbled upon PolyU, right? These students only in virtue of their basically doing a lot of internet searching. They were trying to find universities here in Hong Kong that fit their needs. And one of them does veterinarian medicine, another does fashion design. And so PolyU seemed like a no-brainer for them. But frankly, we weren't reaching out anywhere nearly as aggressively as we could vis-a-vis Vietnam, even though I think Hong Kong U has already made a lot of active efforts when it comes to Vietnam with our new sort of Vietnam center of the business school. And that is obviously a very important bastion where hopefully more initiatives and joint collaboration could be undertaken going forward. I want to give a shout out to that center in Vietnam. But frankly, we should do more in other schools and other disciplines as well in emphasizing. And this is where I get into the second stage, right? These sort of outreach efforts vis-a-vis undergraduate admissions. It's not just about offering more scholarships, which the government has to give it a lot of credit, sought to do over the past 2 years. Mm. It's also about bolstering our visibility and highlighting the fact that we can be, in many ways, a partner to the academic and the education communities in ASEAN, in the Gulf, in Northeast Asia. That sort of discourse isn't present right now. So when you speak of Hong Kong to folks in countries in ASEAN and also the Gulf and even Northeast Asia, they would say shopping. They would say finance, okay? Rule of law, right, which is very important. And Jonathan, you're guarding that.
We'll come on to it.
You're a safeguarder of that. But education is a very much undersold and under-advertised part. You're spot on about that. So where's the discourse, where's the visibility, and where's the attention to the needs of these communities and societies at large? We need more of that.
So let me ask you this. When you think about it, the way that Eton or Harrow or Uppingham Rugby, these English schools, it's not the government, of course, that's promoting them. Yeah. Presumably, they have their own marketing team. I mean, in fact, they do. I know they do. So how do we encourage private schools here to actually start to think of themselves as saleable overseas rather than just locally? Because that's the missing link, isn't it?
I think the first step to that is just affirming the fact that they are indeed up to snuff.
Yeah.
And this is key. I really think the top schools in Hong Kong, you know, I'm not going to name names because I'll end up alienating audience members if I do name names one way or the other. But I'll say that the top schools in Hong Kong are no less competitive.
Yeah, they're good.
Are no less prestigious and also rigorous than many of these top schools you just named just then in Blighty. And for full disclosure, I was a debate coach at one of these colleges for 4 years. So I can tell you the quality of education that young students in Hong Kong can receive on the upper end.
Yeah.
It is not bad at all. But the trouble is we don't see ourselves as needing to cater to non-mainland Chinese and non-Hong Kong students because the market in China is so big, right? And that's a very understandable and also a happy problem. It's a happy problem that we can always fall back on admissions and recruitment of students from up north, from the remainder or the other parts of our country, right? And yet at the same time, what we do need to think about now that the world is getting more complex and there's a rising and burgeoning middle class and upper middle class, right, in Southeast Asia, in the Indian subcontinent, and also the world beyond, is how can we position ourselves as an attractive conduit, as an attractive cradle for top talents and youth there. And a corollary here is we need to get our English standards back to where it had been, right, previously, what it had been in the past.
They've fallen off.
You look at Malaysia's overtaken Singapore. Singapore has long overtaken us in terms of English proficiency. I mean, where's that sort of gusto and that sort of, you know, self-declaration of being proficient in Liang Wensan Yu, right? Two languages and three dialects. Where's that sort of confidence that, frankly, Hong Kong should still have, right? Despite all that's happened and should still hold ourselves to the standards of. And additionally, when it comes to other languages as well and our openness to other cultures, whether it be Malaysian and Indonesian cultures and, of course, the language that they speak, that language is spoken by over 300 million people around the world, right? And yet you don't hear talk of including Bahasa Indonesia or Malay in the DSE curriculum here locally, right? Or alternatively, think about the importance and centrality of Spanish. And yet again, Spanish is not taken up widely as an additional language to equip our denizens and citizens with the ability to navigate not just Spain and in brackets Portugal, because there are differences, but also the Spanish speaking and the Lusophonic countries in Latin America and Africa.
And US.
And the US, of course. So it just baffles me that we talk a lot about our being an international academic and education hub. But when it comes to our high school education, right, going back to stage one in that four-stage process, there's so much we could do quite low-hanging fruits, and yet we aren't willing to do them. That, to me, is what troubles me a lot.
Inertia.
inertia and complacency.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So that's education. Now let's identify the second low-hanging fruit, because education is low-hanging fruit. Children, parents want their children to be educated. If we provide an excellent service, there will be customers.
Mm-hmm.
What next?
Arts and culture.
Yeah. And sport.
Yeah. And sports. Yeah.
And we're pleased, of course, with the new...
It's awesome.
I didn't see it. Did you go to see it?
I did.
That?
I was at the Sevens.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Coldplay.
No. I missed Coldplay. It's something else going on, unfortunately. Yeah.
Me too. I would have liked to have seen it.
It would have been paradise for me in lieu of a sky full of stars instead. Sorry, that's a Coldplay reference.
Yes.
I do like me some Coldplay. So.
I'm hoping that we're going to have Bruce Springsteen here. There's a rumour. We'll see.
Oh, absolutely.
But it's great. It's great that we've got a big stadium.
Hardware's excellent.
The hardware's excellent. They just need to get the acts in.
The software could do with some improvements.
Are we talking about the glitches with tickets or
not
something?
Not so much that. It's more just a sort of sense of, that, yeah, for instance, the directions provision. I was at the Sevens, and I think, to be fair to them, it was a very frenetic environment, but many of the staff there are a bit lost as well,
right,
as to where exactly the boxes were. And
Teething problems.
Exactly, teething problems.
Yeah.
But also the signs and the all sorts of miscellaneous and, frankly, trivial, right? Trivial, mild defects that added up to not necessarily the most smoothest of experiences going in and out of the stadium, but that's just minor. To me, it's more about the overarching observation concerning positioning. We need to use and leverage the Kai Tak Stadium.
We do.
To brand Hong Kong as more than what it currently is, to punch above our weight, right? For all the talk of Singapore being able to monopolize, you know, Lady Gaga's shows in Asia, I mean, we can do... not something similar, because I don't believe in a zero-sum competition, but we can certainly work with Thailand, work with Vietnam, work with all these other countries in the region and bid together for a star's visit. In lieu of having an exclusive performance by this said star here in Hong Kong, we can say, well, why don't we organize and spearhead a regional coordinative effort in bringing X, Y, and Z, right? Maybe a Madonna, if she's still in vogue, or Adele, as I love Adele, or Ed Sheeran, and bring them through to Asia
and make it
be
worth
a bridge between the rest of Asia and these artists, right?
And make it worth their while to be
exactly
here.
Lift all boats up at once.
And if I go back quite a long way, I came here in 1978. In those days, we really did attract most of the stars. If they were coming through Europe, normally down to Australia, Hong Kong would be a venue.
A must
and there were some great acts, world-class acts.
Michael Jackson?
All sorts.
Yeah.
I could spend 10 minutes reeling off stars that came through. So we need to re-establish that. Now, how about the culture centre on West Kowloon?
Honestly, whenever I walk and stroll along the promenade in West Kowloon, I just think to myself, we're so lucky. We're blessed to have this sort of Central Park meets Hyde Park meets the Met.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
The location's prime, the vistas are gorgeous. And again, the hardware of both the M Plus and also the Palace Museum is world class, right? Yeah. And I'd also like to affirm that when people say Hong Kong has no freedom of speech or that our freedoms to engage in artistic expression are curbed and curtailed by political sensitivities, I would always say M Plus. There are lots of interesting works on display in M Plus without further specification, because you can go there for yourself and to see for yourself, that frankly only Hong Kong could platform and exhibit. And I think this is something we ought to extol as a virtue, right? Whether it be the artworks of artists that are deemed too, quote unquote, sensitive for the mainland, or artworks whose contents do not pass the muster test, so to speak, in a mainland vis-a-vis political safety. Well, in Hong Kong, you could see them. And I think that's what One Country, Two Systems is really about. Hong Kong should be able to do things that the mainland can't, not because we should do it for the sake of doing it, but because there's either an instrumental good, or it is an instrument that allows us to unlock some further good, whether it be in attracting tourists and attracting investments and also interest in the arts and cultural market, or because it is also, at the same time, a civic good, right? That we have a more multifarious display and an articulation of the contemporary China story, including the bad bits, including the not so fundamentally glorious, right? The nicest parts of contemporary Chinese history that the country has had to endure. I think it's only fair that here in Hong Kong we get a fuller and more voluptuous picture, provided that what we're talking about here stays within the constraints of literal law. And again, the constraints of the literal law, the actual constraints, are often far less substantial and far less significant than what is construed by domestic political players or, alternatively, international media covering Hong Kong as such.
Brian, that ties in nicely with our last guest, who was Bernard Chang.
Oh, Bernie, yes.
Yeah, Bernard was here, and we were very pleased to have him. And of course, he's absolutely pivotal to the question of West Kowloon.
Mm-hmm.
And he was suggesting that what is happening here is that the local government is forever holding their breath and trying to double guess what Beijing mm-hmm. wants. Now, you sound as if you're agreeing very much with that in your analysis of the arts here. Don't be timid.
Mm-hmm.
Show what we want to show as long as it's within the law. Don't think it's going to offend Beijing. Beijing want us to be different. They want us to be special. They're not playing games with us. We are genuinely a different part of the country with a different system. Does that fit in with your belief system?
I spent over a decade studying and watching Chinese politics and Chinese history from up close. And if I may, throughout this experience, I've come up with three observations that would help me indirectly answer your question, and I'll give you the direct answer after. The first observation is that the Chinese system is best conceptualized as a sprawling bureaucracy with serious, at places, fragmentation, both vertically between different verticals, so different sort of functional specializations. We've got the economics, the trade, the security, and all these bureaus, you know, coming apart really vertically, but also horizontally, right? You've got discontinuities between the central government, the provincial leaderships, the municipal leaderships, the county leaderships, and of course the local officials who are implementing the edicts of what they perceive to be the higher ups, or rather what they perceive to be the wishes of the higher ups. So China is a bureaucracy, and it is a bureaucracy where you don't get the sort of same set of democratic elections and votes that you see, or at least you saw in America. I like the past tense. It's a very powerful tense. You see these days still in Europe, in the UK, of course. But it's fair to say that this system has, by and large, worked in accomplishing and delivering a significant range of socioeconomic objectives. But it's also struggled as a result of how unwieldy at times, how portentous and how ossified and thus calcified the system could become. It is not a perfect system. But this is the first observation about how the Chinese state operates. As a corollary of this, this is a second point, there's a dearth of informational access and also what I call extensive, cross-tier, cross-layer understanding within the system. So if you spoke with someone who's rather junior, right, a Zheng Tuji, who's actually, in a grand scheme of things, already quite senior in a party, but still junior in government, and you asked him, what is the leadership thinking? Well, he would say, well, I look at the documents, I look at the party readouts, I also engage in study sessions, I go online to look for information, I talk to my peers, my counterparts, I speak with my boss, I speak with my subordinates, and here's my picture. Here's my attempt to understand what's going on. And as we all know, in the very unique political system that China has, the tendency and also the preference on a part of bureaucrats is to be risk-averse, is to err on a side of caution and to focus on what's least politically controversial, precisely because they don't have perfect access to what the bosses higher up are thinking. And similarly, on the other end, right, whilst, many in the senior leadership would have a pretty substantial and reasonable understanding of what's going on in the broadest of terms, they too struggle with accessing the details on the ground. And as such, the decisions they make are often quite high level. Okay, it's like a 30,000 feet view. So when you put together a 30,000 feet view generated prescription, like, yes, do it, or why not, or okay, a tick across a circle, and you combine that with folks on the front lines trying to speculate, trying to work out, what is it that we can do that doesn't get us cancelled? What can we do to get ourselves promoted? Remember, this is like a corporation, right, in some sense. They are seeking to rise to the ranks, not through the kind of violent, gung-ho and ad hoc sort of repression that's often attributed, a stereotype to the Chinese system, but instead, they're trying to rise up by ticking all these boxes of a KPI, which may or may not include economic growth amongst a whole roster of other things. Then you're going to end up with a picture where there's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of potential misalignment. And such misalignment cannot be blamed or fault on any particular actor, but it's a structural phenomenon. And now I'm going to throw in the final observation. I don't think we here in Hong Kong, and this applies to everyone, okay? It's not just about the political elite. It's also an economic elite, the old guard, the legal elite, the professional service elite. We don't understand our country, China, nearly as enough as we could. So we don't think about what the leadership wants, right? What we instead look at is, okay, this is my task, this is my job, this is my KPI, I'm going to tick the boxes. I'm going to ensure that I meet the demands. I'm going to ensure that I can minimize unnecessary risk that could impede my prospective career advancements. And that is also why I want to just end my answer on this particular point on a comment that I think there are lots of very good people in Hong Kong government today. There are lots of well-intentioned, serious, technocratically competent individuals in a government today. Okay, and I will stand by that comment. But that does not therefore mean that the system as a whole in here in Hong Kong is able to adapt to the changing geopolitical realities and the storms that await us in the open seas. Nor does it mean that the bureaucracy is thus able to connect with the demands and also the needs and concerns of the ordinary and average Hong Konger, right? I'm not saying there's an inevitable disconnect. What I'm saying here, though, is that we are not necessarily seeing the kind of communication and also take into consideration, as well as channeling into action, of the inputs and voices of people on the ground as we ideally should. And any sound government system, whether it be democratic or non-democratic, and I study authoritarianism, mind you, as a part of my specialization, right, area of specialization, any sound government system, democratic or non-democratic, must be responsive to its people's interests. That is the bottom line. And whichever system and whichever set of mechanisms allows for the government in succeeding in so doing, that's a good system. And so that's, I guess, my indirect way of answering your question, whilst also trying to shed light on what I see to be an important facet of Chinese politics that folks don't often think about. I hope that's okay with you.
Brian, thank you so much. We can speak all day, but we're going to take a break now, and we shall be back in a week or two with part two. Thank you.
Sounds good. See you.